Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You'll hear the phrase back to pre-recession levels on the broadcast today. Also, the word sequester and the word Obamacare. Stick around. We'll make it worth your while. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for the 30th of April. It's a Tuesday. Good to have you with us. I come bearing quite exciting news, in fact, about the American housing market. It comes in the form of the monthly Case-Shiller Home Price Index. And I'm going to violate one of the key rules of doing business news on the radio right now and just read you a bunch of numbers. I don't want to, but sometimes the story says you gotta, so here we go. Home prices in the 20 cities that Case-Shiller tracks were up 9.3% over a year ago. That's the biggest bump since 2006, back in the day, as they say. And more to the point, the trend seems to be going in the right direction. For the first time in 8 years, all 20 cities had higher prices for 2 months in a row. So the economy has that going for it, at least, no matter what else you hear out there. State budgets, meanwhile, are bouncing back from years of financial crisis and recession. There's some new data out from the Census Bureau that says state budgets are back to where they used to be, pre-recession levels. There's the first one. Marketplace's David Weinberg has more now on how that money's being spent.
States collected nearly $800 billion last year. That's the highest level ever recorded. The recovery of state budgets has been fueled by increases in state income taxes, sales taxes, and real estate taxes.
Our tax revenues have finally recovered their pre-recession levels.
Fred Church is the deputy budget director with the Ohio Office of Budget Management. The return to pre-recession levels has allowed the state to spend money on programs that had been cut during the recession.
In this budget, we were able to put a significant amount of money back into K-12 education.
And much like other states, Ohio is using its budget surplus to repay the state's rainy day fund.
We'll probably bring the rainy day fund up to its target level of 5% of revenues.
Ohio also hopes to take advantage of the budget surplus and lower state income taxes.
You can look at states like Kansas, Missouri, Ohio, Minnesota, Massachusetts that are looking at making different types of tax changes.
Todd Haggerty is a fiscal policy analyst at the National Conference for State Legislators. He says that depending on the political climate, some states are using surpluses to lower taxes, while others are using the revenue to restore services.
Things are improving. They're at a stronger spot than they have been in previous years. We're just not seeing the robust recovery that typified previous recoveries.
Haggerty says it only took states 1 or 2 years to get back to pre-recession levels in both the 91 and 2001 recessions. This time around, it's taken 4 years. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
4 years is, quite coincidentally, about how long it takes to earn a college degree. But as more people start to question the high price of said education, colleges are scrambling to figure out how to use technology to save money and stay competitive. A lot of them, as you've heard, are turning to online classes, but faculty have now started to push back. From the education desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott has that story.
Last fall, Duke University announced a plan to offer online courses for credit through a company called 2U. Last week, Duke's faculty said not so fast. Tom Robichaud is chair of the Arts and Sciences Council, which voted down the contract. He says some professors didn't like how the administration handled the deal. Others just aren't wild about teaching online.
I think we at Duke need a little bit more time to think about this. And the only way we will get answers to some of these questions is actually to try a pilot project at some point.
Faculty at Amherst College also decided not to jump in. Earlier this month, they rejected an invitation to team up with Harvard and MIT to offer free online courses. Stephen George is professor of biology and neuroscience at Amherst, a very selective small college in Massachusetts.
We work with students pretty closely, and the idea of teaching 100,000 students remotely just doesn't seem like it fit Amherst's goals and values.
Faculty at both schools say they haven't ruled out online education, but Elaine Allen with the Babson Survey Research Group says tenured professors have been slow to embrace it. In an annual survey, less than a third of chief academic officers said their faculty accept the value of teaching online.
Over the 10 years that we have done our survey, faculty opinion of online education really has not changed.
And it may not, she says, until her generation of college professors retires. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, housing up, stocks up. It's not quite a perfect correlation, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Yesterday on the broadcast, Marketplace's Jeff Tyler and Michael Graybell from ProPublica brought us the results of their joint investigation into labor contracting practices in Chicago. Contracting and subcontracting are nothing new in American business, especially in big American businesses. But as happens when you add to a production process, every layer of activity adds cost. In this case, with subcontractors who use a network of informal labor brokers to recruit warehouse workers, those costs wind up being imposed on the workers themselves. They wind up having to pay to get a job. So today, in part two of our investigation, Jeff explains how that business model benefits companies.
In the airport on my way to Chicago, I paid $5 for a pink plush troll named Trixie. It's made by Tye, the company behind Beanie Babies.
It's cute.
It's a perfect toy for our baby.
My granddaughter would like it.
That's the reaction I got when I showed Trixie to people on the street in Chicago. But some middle-aged Latino women had different associations. They knew it from the Tye warehouse.
It reminds me of the pain that I felt in my hands.
The owners of the company don't pay us for the hours that we worked.
That's a big difference in perceptions. It mirrors the gap between the laborer in China who made Trixie and the owner of the company, Tye Warner, estimated to be worth $2.5 billion. And the disparity at Tye is almost as striking right here at home. Latino immigrants do the work at Tye, but they're not paid by Tye. A temporary staffing company hires and pays them. And that company relies on informal labor brokers to recruit and transport workers. So you have two intermediaries between Tye and its workers. To see how that makes business sense, let's consider the different players involved in bringing Trixie to market. Let's start with the workers at the Tye warehouse, 40 minutes outside Chicago.
I'm here hoping that I can do an interview with somebody from the company about...
Private property, so you're not allowed here.
Shut down here, I go looking for warehouse workers in the neighborhood where they live.
I'm standing on 26th Street, which is the main thoroughfare for Little Village, which is the Latino part of Chicago. There's Marquis Medicos next to La Tienda de Dollar, next to Restaurante Sabor.
Elizabeth Baido lives in a small apartment a few blocks from here. She moved to Chicago from Mexico when she was 8. Now she's 19 and doesn't have many job prospects.
A lot of times I am capable to get the job, but it's just that once it comes down to filling the application, first thing they ask you for is your social security number, and that's something that I don't have.
From last summer until February, she worked at the Tye warehouse where she packed dolls like Trixie.
There were all Mexican workers there. There wasn't no white workers there. There was no Chinese. There was nothing but, you know, Hispanics.
Workers like Baido make minimum wage, minus the money they pay to the middlemen directly above them, underground labor brokers called Riteros. The Ritero connects workers with temporary jobs, and in return, workers are obligated to pay for a ride to work. That's what the Riteros get out of it, $8 a day for each worker shuttled to a warehouse. The economic interests are more complicated for the next link in the chain. A temp staffing company called Select Remedy is responsible for paying the workers. It's part of the Select family of staffing companies, one of the biggest temp firms in the U.S. To find out how staffing companies might benefit from using the Riteros as intermediaries, I visited this office in downtown Chicago, overlooking the L train. Employment lawyer Chris Williams has represented workers from Little Village in wage disputes with the temp companies.
I think they're trying to create a level of deniability that if there's a problem with the pay, that it's not their problem, it's the Reitero's problem.
In the end, it's often left as the worker's problem. Elizabeth Bellido says she got cheated in her paycheck from Select Remedy.
I actually had to come in on a Sunday, and we worked a full day. They told us they were going to pay us double time, which was $16 per hour, and we didn't get that in our paychecks.
In a statement, Select Remedy says it has, quote, no relationship with the private van drivers who provide transportation to the job site for some of our associates, unquote. But I spoke with several workers who say they contacted Select Remedy about a missing payment and were referred to speak with their van driver. Leone Bakiri hears the stories too. He's executive director of the Chicago Workers Collaborative. Bakiri says the layers of intermediaries insulate companies from responsibility for hiring undocumented immigrants.
The majority of the staffing agencies prefer the Latino immigrant workers with the belief that they will hopefully complain less about a variety of abuses.
Not everyone buys that idea. John Osborne researches temp companies for Staffing Industry Analysts.
If you're asking me, is it a normal practice for staffing firms to hire illegal workers? Hell no. You know, I mean, these people can lose their entire business for something like that.
Osborne says companies like Thai report using temp firms mostly to have a just-in-time workforce. Thai Incorporated did not respond to repeated requests for comment. Trixie, Thai's pink stuffed troll, isn't the only product that comes to market through this complicated system of subcontracted labor. Our investigation found that Reiteros bring immigrant workers to temp jobs for brands including Fresh Express, Sony, Frito-Lay, and Smirnoff. In Chicago, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
You can hear all the stories from our joint investigation with ProPublica, Taken for a Ride, it's called. They're online at marketplace.org. Before it left town last Friday, Congress solved at least one sequester-related snafu. Those air traffic control delays have been dispatched. But what about all the other ways budget cuts have hit us or will hit us? The National Institutes of Health says, thanks to the sequester, it has lost about $1.5 billion that would ordinarily have gone for biomedical research. Dr. Francis Collins is the director of the NIH. Dr. Collins, good to have you with us.
Nice to be with you.
Give me the thumbnail sketch, would you, of medical research and innovation in medicine in this country today?
It is a fantastically exciting time. All of us involved in medical research are exhilarated by the pace at which discoveries are now possible. Technology has played a big role in that, and I will not be able to resist mentioning that one of those is genomics, since I had the privilege of leading the Genome Project. That has made it possible to do things that I wouldn't have imagined could have been done in our lifetime.
I wonder, though, the state of medical research in the current political environment. Maybe I should have better phrased my question.
Well,
he smiles broadly before answering the question.
I'm happy to say that support for medical research down through the decades has been very much a bipartisan effort. This is not an issue that seems to have particular appeal to one party or the other. Medical research is about all of us, our loved ones, ourselves, and it's also a great way of stimulating the economy. So what's not to love here?
Well, but surely you are being affected by the sequester.
We are. Because we're part of the discretionary budget.
Yeah.
And so this poison pill that when originally designed, it was intended to be so poisonous that no one would swallow it. It got swallowed and we got poisoned.
I can't help but wonder, though, what went through your mind when you saw the air traffic control situation and Congress falling all over itself to fix that?
When you look at air traffic control, it affects people in an obvious way. Medical research, maybe not so obvious. The lead time between making a discovery and having a clinical benefit is years. But we are putting a generation of young scientists at serious risk by the loss of about $1.7 billion from our budget halfway through the fiscal year.
Tell me more about that. Imagine you, instead of being the, what, 65-ish-year-old man you are?
63.
I apologize.
But put yourself in some kids, you know, some 25-year-old postdoc shoes right now. What are you thinking when you look at the state of things?
Well, I know very well because I spent last weekend in Chicago meeting with the MD-PhD students who are part of the American Physician Scientist Association, a wonderfully gifted group of visionary young scientists. This is our future. And when I've met with them in the past, they wanted to talk all about the science they were thinking about and the ideas they had. And this year, they're asking, is there a future for us? Do we have a career path? Should we think about doing something else or maybe going to another country? The anxiety is palpable and understandable considering what's happening.
Do you worry that the NIH might be defunded out of existence someday just in this rush to cut government spending?
I can't imagine a rational society, which we claim to be and generally are, making that case, because when you consider what NIH has done for the health of our society, it is dramatic. And then you add up what that means to the economy, my gosh. But it's also about our health and about the ability to be able to prevent and treat terrible diseases that are going to afflict all of us eventually if we don't have better answers. So we are a great way to spend your money.
When was the last time you actually got to spend some of that research money, doing work in a lab or talking to a patient?
Actually, last week. I have a lab.
Really?
Yeah, I have a lab, about 10 people. We work on diabetes and we work on aging, and we're making substantial advances.
Are you ever tempted to chuck this whole NIH thing and just go to your lab?
The lab is wonderful mental health for me when I'm getting a little bit frustrated with the political circumstances and the budgetary squeeze. And it also keeps me anchored in the reality of what science is capable of doing, which is exhilarating. And things that are being done by single postdocs in my lab, I could not have imagined a group of 100 people being able to do 10 years ago. It's just that's the way in which things are advanced.
Francis Collins, he's the director of the NIH, National Institutes of Health. Dr. Collins, thanks a lot for coming in.
Great to be with you, Guy.
Coming up.
I don't really have anything to say about Google now or ever.
Oh, snap. Digital personal assistants get serious. But first, let's do the numbers. On Wall Street today, bonds saved the day for stocks. I'll explain that in a minute. The Dow Industrials recovered from early losses, rose 21 points. The blue chips did, 10%, closed at 14,839. The NASDAQ swelled 21 points as well, 0.2% there. Finished at 3328. The S&P 500 inched up 3 points, 0.2%, ended things at 1597. The big market news today was all about bonds. Apple uncorked a $17 billion offering, the biggest debt issued by a non-financial company. Shares gained nearly 3%, and that boosted other tech stocks. IBM picked up 1.7% today. For newspaper stocks, good news failed to move investors. New York Times shares fell at 10% despite some circulation gains. Bond prices held steady. The yield on the 10-year T-note stayed at 1.67%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for March. Facebook posts a status update. It is scheduled to release quarterly earnings. And May is National Barbecue Month. It's also National Salad Month. I think these things can be combined nicely, don't you? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Score this one for the simpler is better crowd. The topic is Obamacare, the start of which draws closer every single day. The administration said today the form that you have to fill out to buy insurance on one of those new online health insurance exchanges has been sliced from 21 pages down to 3. The idea, of course, is to make it as easy as possible for people to sign up because, number one, it's the law, and number two, if not everybody signs up, then it's not going to work. But if, or maybe when, all else fails, there is punishment, too, a penalty of anywhere from $95 up to 1% of your income, whichever is more, which doesn't really seem like much of an incentive when insurance can cost thousands of dollars. But Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports from the health desk at WHYY, even a wimpy penalty like that one might work better than you think.
There are lots of penalties in life.
like jail in the NFL.
Face mask number 32, 5 yards.
And one we can all relate to.
Come on, come on, come on, man. I was only in there 2 minutes. Don't give me a ticket. Come on.
And they're all pretty effective. But the individual penalty under the Affordable Care Act, the 1% of your income or about $400 on a $40,000 a year salary, behavioral economists say it's a problem.
It sounds very small.
Just too small.
Small.
Too small to change anyone's mind.
Yes, I mean, $95. That's a full tank of gas for an SUV here in Texas.
Now, it must be said, the Obama administration isn't counting on the penalty to move the masses. It believes people will buy insurance because they need it. And for many, the government will help them pay for it. The penalty? It's kind of a backup motivator. And University of Pennsylvania behavioral economist Kevin Volp says it can work.
Yeah, the basic phenomenon is called loss aversion. Sorry, I'm trying to avoid using any jargon here.
Here's the point. Say you bought a house for $200,000. Now it's on the market and someone offers you $199,500. No deal.
People will often cling to that initial purchase price and insist that they will not sell for a penny less, even if they've moved out of the house and it's costing them $1,000 a month to hold on to the house.
Even if it's the $5 you lost in the college basketball pool. It's the losing, Volp says, not the loss that matters. Another thing about the penalty, if you don't buy insurance, it's a reminder you're not following the rules.
Americans are a very law-abiding people.
MIT economist John Gruber.
For example, people don't cheat nearly as much in their taxes as they should, and not as they should in a moral sense, but what would be financially optimal for them. If people think it's the law to do something, they by and large do it.
Starting next year, you'll be asked about health insurance when you file your taxes. Duke University behavioral scientist Peter Ubel is betting that'll have an effect.
There will be a reckoning. We have to tell them whether we have insurance or not. And if we don't have it, that might really feel bad and be enough to change your mind about what you want to do next year.
Plenty of people don't have the luxury to give in to subtle psychological cues and nudges. Take 31-year-old Liana Gray, a massage therapist in upstate New York. She's run the numbers. Gray could pay the one-time $400 penalty or buy subsidized insurance for about $315 a month.
That is like border of what I was considering acceptable. You know, I don't have health problems, so it's like a gamble that I'm choosing.
It's a gamble the government estimates roughly 6 million Americans will take and pay the fine. But behavioral economists think there's still something that could move the holdouts. Good old-fashioned peer pressure.
We've got it.
We've got it.
Got what? Health insurance. Massachusetts.
That ad ran during Boston Red Sox games at Fenway in 2007 as Massachusetts rolled out health care reform. MIT's John Gruber says you're sending a social signal. This is what's coming. It's inevitable.
We said you got to have health insurance. We didn't mention or you have to pay a penalty. Basically, people felt, gee, this is the new thing to do to get health insurance. The state wants me to get it. They've passed a law saying I should get it. I'm going to go get it.
And you know what? The plan helped. Estimates say a majority of the uninsured signed up for coverage within a year and a half of the bill passing. But not every state's going to play ball.
Ads at the Astros game are not going to work.
Vivian Ho teaches economics at Rice University in Houston.
There are some people, particularly here in Texas, who have a visceral hatred towards Obamacare, as they refer to it.
Ho thinks many will simply refuse to pay. In fact, paying the penalty will be a point of pride. But pride's going to get more expensive. By 2016, the penalty ratchets up to 2.5% of your income. Ho says high enough for people to feel the pinch. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
There are days when you love this job, and there are days when stuff like this happens.
Kai, I've been meaning to tell you, hosting a public radio show is not hard. You are easily replaced by me.
That may at some point be true, but not quite yet. And in fact, Google is going after Siri on her home turf, a new personal assistant for the iPhone and Android called Google Now. And it's not just competition for the voice of Apple, but for the future of search as well. Marketplace's Queen of Kim takes it from there.
So, Siri, what do you have to say about Google Now coming to the iPhone?
I don't really have anything to say about Google Now, or ever.
You may want to reconsider that. Google Now takes all the data we feed it, our searches, what we buy, where we are, to learn our habits and give us information before we ask for it. I use an iPhone and downloaded Google Now yesterday, but so far, it's not very useful. Just weather and location, and Siri doesn't have your personality.
Here is a map of Big Sur.
If you just started using Google Now, it hasn't learned that much about your habits yet.
Liz Gaines is a senior editor at the tech blog All Things D. She's got an Android and has been using Google's personal assistant app for a while now. It knows a lot about her, like when she's leaving town.
I was taking a United flight, so my boarding pass had been emailed to my Gmail account. And the morning of the flight, it pops up in Google Now with your boarding pass right there.
So this is what's becoming the next frontier in mobile search.
Tony Costa is an analyst at Forrester. He says, right now, search is mostly about asking for information, but the trend is to give it to you before you ask for it. And in this respect, Google Now is way ahead of Apple. Tammy Mattson is a business professor at Santa Clara University.
There is a lot to catch up on if we think about the search capabilities behind a Google Now type feature.
She says while Apple's been focusing on hardware, Google spent more than a decade collecting our data and getting to know us. In San Francisco, I'm Quina Kim for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which comes to us courtesy of Bloomberg. You remember the kerfuffle during and after the financial crisis about executive pay, how disconnected it seemed to be from reality and what regular people were making as well? Bloomberg points out today that the rules designed to force disclosure of CEO salaries has been held up by lobbying in Congress, so it's done some analysis of its own. The CEO with the paycheck that's the most removed from what his average employee made, Ron Johnson, who ran JCPenney for about a year and a half until he was fired not too long ago, he made 1,795 times what a JCPenney clerk made. We've got a link to the Bloomberg data set on our website. It is marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace, the radio show from APM Today. We got to go. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Katie Long, Lina Anwar, and Justin Ho on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.